Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. I'm Susan Wall, and I'm reading August Gale by Maine author Barbara Walsh, copyright 2012 by Barbara Walsh, and published by GPP in Guilford, Connecticut. Today we're beginning Episode 7, on page 85 of this 247-page book. In Episode 6, Barbara and her sisters argued whether their grandfather Ambrose's abandonment of their dad, uncle, and grandmother was in any way forgivable. We also learn that Barbara and her sister Joni are planning a trip to Newfoundland with their dad to visit newfound family there. Next, a chapter set in 1935 Marystown described Father McGettigan's torment. He is near a breaking point from years of pastoring the poor fishing families. As the episode closed, Barbara is finally seeing pictures of her grandfather Ambrose, sent by a relative in Newfoundland. And now, Episode 7. The second picture portrays Ambrose many years earlier. He and his brother Leo stand in a garden in front of Leo's Staten Island home. The summer flowers are in bloom. Carnations and petunias frame the picket fence that rises up behind the two men. In his 30s, Ambrose wears a short-sleeve, button-down shirt, trousers, and a tie that is loosened around his neck. While Leo smiles and stares at whoever is taking the photograph, Ambrose's gaze is unfocused, haunted, as if he had just learned of some terrible news. His left hand is clenched, ready to strike something or someone. His shoulders slump forward. His mouth remains slightly ajar, like he had been suddenly sucker-punched. I wonder what troubles my grandfather in this frozen moment of time. Was the photograph taken in August 1935? Snapped days or weeks after Ambrose had learned about the August gale that tore up Newfoundland's coast? Was it the killer hurricane that preoccupied my grandfather? Except for the wedding band on my grandfather's left hand, there is no hint of my Nana in the photograph. Was she standing in front of Ambrose and Leo? Did she take the picture? Or was she inside her home, cradling her newborn son, Ronnie, holding a warm milk bottle to his mouth? Unlike the other picture, in which my grandfather poses for the camera lens and flashes an easy smile, this image captures him unguarded, off-kilter. He is vulnerable, lost, and I wish I could step into the photograph, step back in time to learn what has disturbed him, left him with the punch-drunk gaze. I open up the third and final picture of my grandfather, and a wave of anger washes over me. In this snapshot, Ambrose is in his late 60s or early 70s. He and his second wife, Arlene, sit at a table. Their heads tilt toward each other, touching. Arlene's honey-colored hair is swept back in a chignon. She wears a dress and a dark cardigan. Her thin lips blush with color and press together with a hint of a smile. Her eyes are almond-shaped. Her cheekbones high, chiseled. She is a beautiful woman. Ambrose rests his forearm on the table. His mouth is open, forming a word, as if he were telling the photographer, "Hurry up and take the goddamn picture," a phrase my father often utters when anyone takes too long to snap the shutter button. There are white crumbs scattered on the table before Ambrose and Arlene, and the edge of what looks like a sheet cake on the photograph's border. Were they celebrating an anniversary? Marking the decades they had been together? They seem comfortable, at ease with one another and their opposite personalities. My grandfather, blustery, full of himself, a charismatic character. Arlene, reserved, shy, and unsure. Just as I never imagined my grandfather's face, I never considered Arlene's likeness. Scrutinizing her portrait, I realized that I do not have any strong feelings against her. Oddly, I do not harbor anger for this woman, who allowed my Nana to care for her firstborn, who shared tea with my grandmother in a small San Francisco apartment, and who ultimately won Ambrose back. My hostility is reserved for my grandfather, the married man who strayed with a woman 10 years his junior. I shut off the computer, erasing Ambrose and Arlene's faces from my screen. Still, the image of my grandfather lingers in my mind, resurrecting my father's stories about San Francisco and the difficult years that followed. These photographs give form and flesh to my grandfather. He is suddenly real to me, no longer faceless, vague, undefined. My memory now can conjure Ambrose's eyes, his muscular build and thick forearms, characteristics that live on in my father. From my own scrapbook, I pull photographs of my grandmother. There are 3 sepia-colored prints. 2 of them depict my Nana when she is 7 or 8. In one image, she stands with 4 younger children, her half-brothers and sisters, from her father's second wife. My Nana, Patricia Mary O'Connell, wears a white dress with a sailor's collar accentuated with a broad dark tie. Her blonde hair is cut in a page boy, and several strands are pulled back in a bow. There is a smile, pure and innocent, on her face. She is pretty, and at this moment, the future of the successful Irish builder's daughter holds only promise and prosperity. A picture taken 10 years later shows my Nana sitting on the front steps of her Staten Island home, her arm wrapped around Eleanor's back. There is another younger girl, perhaps another sister, in the photograph, too. Nana and Eleanor both wear dresses, nylons. While Eleanor wears high heels, her older sister Patricia presses flat, laced, common-sense shoes against the stair riser. The summer sun is bright, casting dark shadows on the large window shutters that fill the corners of the porch. A vine creeps up one side of the house, and bushes rise up the other. Patricia is perhaps 16 or 17. She is tall, big-boned, and her hair is now cut in a bob. She is a striking young girl who stares at the camera with only a hint of a smile. Had she met Ambrose yet, I wonder? Has the son of Newfoundland fishermen asked her out? Has she fallen for the dark-eyed young man whom she will forever love? The last image in my scrapbook shows Nana again with her older sister, Ruth McCormack. Ruth and her family had taken in my Nana, Dad, and Uncle when they returned from San Francisco and had nowhere else to live. In the picture, the 2 of them stand by a 1940s car. The passenger door is open. Ruth rests a white-gloved hand on the back door. She is dressed fashionably with a long skirt and matching bolero coat. Nana wears a long dark skirt and a white short-sleeve blouse adorned with a flower corsage. Perhaps it is Easter Sunday, and they are either coming or going to church. While Ruth gazes toward the inside of the car, her younger sister glances down toward the sidewalk. Nana's brow is furrowed, her lips are pressed together. Her arms hang limply by her sides, and she appears sad, worn. Triple-decker homes line the streets in the background. How soon after the California trip was the picture taken, I wonder? How many years have passed since she arrived in Dorchester and Watertown, penniless and shamed, forced to ask her sisters and brother for help? Another photograph shows my father and Uncle Bill with one of Ruth's sons, their cousin, David McCormack. The picture was taken, I presume, on the same Easter day. My father and uncle wear suits and pose in the McCormacks' backyard. Handsome in his Sunday clothes, my dad's stance is nonchalant, cocky, as if nothing or no one could faze him. He is 15 or 16, a few years away from joining the Navy, a young man who has washed his hands of his father and looks instead toward his own future, pushing away the past like a bad dream. Chapter 11. A Premonition and a Dark Cloud. Marystown, August 1935. Lillian placed the tea kettle on the cook stove and rubbed her palms together for warmth. She pulled her shawl tighter and peered out the window. The sky to the east was clear, the wind still. A good omen, she thought. There were no signs of gales, no dark clouds. Patty and her sons would be off in a few hours, their schooners sailing in the blackest part of night. The thought of it, all of them, leaving together, stirred a chill deep inside her bones. They would sail 40 miles southeast to Cape St. Mary's, then on to Cape Pine. Sure now there were plenty of sunkers, jagged rocks, there in the capes, but Lillian took comfort knowing her sons would not journey as far as the Grand Banks, or near the treacherous Sable Island. Patty promised her they would sail no farther than 5 miles from shore. There the shoal water measured 20 and 30 fathoms deep, not deep enough for a body to disappear. What could happen so close to land? So close to safe harbors. "Things will be fine," Lillian whispered. "Please the Lord, things will be fine." The kettle rattled on the stove, drawing her thoughts back inside. Steam rose from the spout, prompting Lillian to shake her head at the memory of Patty weeks past, coming home hungry after having one too many jars of rum. "Where's me dinner?" he shouted to the maid after he stumbled through the kitchen door. "'Tis not ready yet, sir," the young woman replied, her voice quavering. "But your food will be on the table shortly now." Not happy with her response, Patty pounded the kettle with his fist, slamming the spout clean into its metal innards. Shouting and muttering to himself, he retreated to the kitchen settee, put his head down, and took a nap, his hand no worse for the smashing he had given the teapot. Did not seem to hurt him at all, Lillian thought. He was tougher than a rock and just as thick. She wished she had a penny for every time he had broken up a piece of furniture in a fit of rage or drunken foolishness. But then there was the gentler side of Patty, the side few but Lillian and her children witnessed. She cherished those moments, the proud look in his eyes when he read the school report cards of his sons and daughters, and his long, hearty whistle over the high marks that each of them had earned. The faraway sound to his voice when he took in the sight of his seven children walking along the footpath to Sunday Mass. "We are some lucky," he told her. "Grandkids they are, every one of them." The smile on his lips when he boasted of James at the helm. "Ah, you should have seen him, Lil. A right smart skipper he is, plotting the course to the banks like he'd been doing it all his life. Me son will make a fair captain, he will." The back door swung open, and Patty's heavy leather jackboots slapped the floor. Lillian straightened herself, preparing for the ritual that was inevitable as the rising sun. He had said goodbye to her and the children hundreds of times, yet her nagging fear, her relentless angst, never wavered. Forcing her tears aside, she pulled two cups and the tin of tea from the cupboard. "Fine evening, Lil," he told her, his voice booming across the kitchen. Before she could answer, footsteps echoed down the stairs, growing louder as they raced through the hall and into the kitchen. "Da!" their youngest daughter, little Lillian, squealed as she ran to her father. "Da, why can't I go along with ye and the boys?" "Ah, Lillian, you're a bit young yet for these journeys, and ye do know that the Dory men are a superstitious lot. A woman on a boat is bad luck to them now, me girl." Lillian frowned and tugged on the sleeve of her dress. 7 years old, she took to fishing like a cat to milk, more at ease with a rod and hooks than the dolls and books that lined her bedroom shelves. "Why is it you won't take me on your sails?" she often asked. "I don't want to be left behind, da." To console her wounded feelings, Patty frequently took his daughter fishing by the small creek near their home. The two of them had spent many hours there with their rods, hauling trout from the cold waters. "I'll take ye fishing when I return. We'll pack a picnic and hike into the woods for our own adventure." Lillian hugged her father and kissed his cheek. "I'll miss ye, da," she told him. Patty watched his daughter turn on her heels and run from the kitchen. He knew Lillian's tears would be streaming down her face before she cloistered herself in her bedroom, angry and hurt. How he cursed these goodbyes! He despised the lot of it, the weeping, the worried faces, the look in his family's eyes, the unspoken question, "What if we never see ye again?" The smell of tea brewing pulled Patty's gaze to the table where his wife sat. She spoke to him softly, her voice distracted. "Come and have a cup of tea now, Patty." He pushed the kitchen chair aside and sat down. Lillian's gaze focused out the window toward the darkening sky. Patty studied her profile, her lips pressed tightly together. After 23 years of marriage, he knew her thoughts as well as his own. The fearsome images she conjured in her mind, the rough seas, sudden winds, and mountainous waves. "Calm waters this evening, Lil," he told her, "still and steady." "Yes, but the weather can turn, can't it, Patty? Turn quicker than a flash of lightning." "I've always come home, haven't I, Lil?" She nodded and turned away at the sound of small feet shuffling along the wooden floor. "Here's me boy," Patty called to his son, Patty Jr. The 4-year-old climbed up on his father's lap, his small fingers tugging on his Patty's hand. "Play, Dada?" "Not tonight, lad. When I come home, there will be plenty of time to play. Plenty of time." Intrigued by the family cat, the boy slid off his father's lap to chase the pet as it ran into the parlor. "Where are me girls Lottie and Tessie?" Patty asked of his older daughters. "Tessie is off saying goodbye to Billy Reed, and Lottie is putting in extra hours tending the till at the store," Lillian explained. "They'll find you before you go. They know your plans to leave at midnight." Patty knew Tessie, like her mother, was none too happy about this journey. She was engaged to Billy Reed, a member of James's crew on the Mary Bernice. A schoolteacher, Tessie doted on her students as if they were her own. The girl pined for a wedding and children she could coddle from morn to night. Patty remembered how Lillian had wanted the same. A thin wisp of a woman, Lillian Ducey had lived on the north side of Marystown. One look at her and Patty had been smitten, drawn in by the sight of her dark hair, bright eyes, and the way she carried herself, regal and proper, like she was the Queen of England. They courted for a few years, and Patty proposed to Lillian in the fall of 1911. The two of them were married when Patty was sure to be on land and not at sea. As the winter wind tore across the bay and the January snows fell, the couple stood before a priest and received the sacrament of matrimony on a Saturday in 1912. Over the next 4 years, Lillian birthed James, Loretta, and Teresa, guarding each of the babies against the rampant diseases that tore through the small outport. The three children thrived, and Lillian's prayers and good fortune held until she birthed Cornelius in 1917. The infant died of pneumonia 3 months later. A year after his death, Lillian held another newborn, Mary Bernice, in her arms, only to lose the girl 5 months later to the same wretched illness that claimed Cornelius. How Patty had cursed the Lord then, cursed God Almighty for taking their two infants. Patty could still hear Lillian's wails, the sobs that tormented their home for months on end. He had worried his wife would never recover from her grief, but then their luck turned. Lillian birthed 4 more children, who thrived and filled their home with a constant laughter. Still, Lillian never forgot the loss, the two infants buried in the ground. She fretted over each of her surviving sons and daughters, fearful of their ragged coughs, their fevered brows. She lived in dread of burying another child, losing them to disease or the cold, deep sea. Patty took in the sight of her now as she peered out the window, her gaze focused on the hills of Little Bay and the water that led to the fishing grounds. Lillian turned to meet her husband's eyes. "Patty," she started, the beginning of a plea, but before the words tumbled from her lips, a sudden gust of wind silenced her. A queer breeze had stirred up the meadow outside, pelting sand and grass against the window. "Dear Lord," Lillian screamed. Startled, her eyes scanned the horizon for an oncoming storm. "Where did such a wind come from on such a still night?" Patty shook his head and reached across the table for his wife's hand. "It's just a whirlwind, my dear. Nothing to worry yourself over." Patty stood and placed his cap on his head. "I've delayed it long enough, Lil. I'd best be off and have another look on board the schooner before we set out." Lillian followed her husband through the hall, her long skirt dragging along the pine boards beneath her. The smell of salt water and freshly cut hay drifted into the parlor as Patty pushed open the front door. Lillian stepped outside onto the porch and turned to the sky. In the east, a single cloud, black as tar, loomed in the otherwise clear night. Lillian shook off a chill and remembered the date, August 20th. The day her daughter, Mary Bernice, died of pneumonia. Dread and fear struck her heart. Surely the sudden whirlwind, the dark cloud, portended death, disaster. And in just a few hours, her eldest son, James, would sail off on Mary Bernice, trailing Patty's schooner. "Patty, please do not sail tonight," she begged, pointing to the large, ominous cloud. Patty looked into his wife's eyes, saddened by her sudden fit of terror. He pulled her close and tucked her head against his shoulder. "If it will comfort ye, we will sleep on board tonight. We will not sail until daylight." Lillian nodded and whispered in her husband's ear, "Look after them, Patty. Bring my sons home, safe ashore." She watched him go, a shadow in the dark, his figure growing smaller as he disappeared beyond their white picket fence to the footpath that led to the wharf. On the southern shores of Marystown, lamps cast shadows on the faces of other fathers, husbands, and sons who bid their own families farewell. In the small, modest homes nestled along the bay, the crew of Mary Bernice and Annie Anita packed their sea bags. Spare woolen socks, extra jumpers and pants, sou'wester hats, oilskins, tins of tobacco, boxes of matches, and pictures of their families, daughters, mothers, and their betrothed, pictures they would hang in their bunks or keep in pockets pressed against their hearts. In their small drawstring bags they placed their religious tokens, palm-sized crosses, Blessed Virgin medals, tiny bottles of holy water, and bits of burned Ash Wednesday palms. If the waves grew to mountains and the wind roared, they held the crosses and medals and they prayed. They sprinkled holy water and ashes into the angry sea, beseeching Mary, the Mother of God, to calm the waters, to guide them home. It was never easy for the fishermen to bid their families farewell, but an August journey conjured more than the usual discontent among the dorymen. Still their tongues did not speak of the gales. Their voices did not utter apprehension about the violent storms that struck suddenly, stirring a silent sea into a roiling devil. No, it was no good talking about such worries. But each of them, the fishermen and their wives, felt the fear as if it were a living, breathing being that walked among them. Odd misgivings gripped Dominic Walsh as he paced the floor of his family's kitchen. Patty's nephew, Dominic, had a berth as a dorryman on board Annie Anita. Rattled about his unease, Dominic turned to his mother, who sat before the fire cradling a cup of tea. "Should I go, Ma? Should I leave? I have a peculiar feeling about this trip." His mother, Margaret, understood her boy's angst. Soon to be married, Dominic did not want to leave his betrothed behind. But she also harbored misgivings about this August journey. She feared the storms that had no mercy for the lives of fathers and sons. "Don't go, Dominic," she told him. "I have me own worries about this trip." "But how will I be paying for the house I'm building for meself and me bride? I can't be slacking off now." Dominic hoisted his duffel and hugged his mother goodbye. "I'll see ye in a week or so," he told her. She watched his thin frame retreat down the hill. "Safe seas to ye, son," she whispered, pushing back her tears. "Safe seas, please God." Past the hills leading to Little Bay, Bride Hanrahan watched her father pack for his journey. The 15-year-old girl relished time with her father when he was ashore. She had hoped her da would treat her and her siblings to some singing, dancing in the kitchen before his journey, but her father's mouth organ had remained untouched in its place by the mantel. Bride had noticed her father's sullen spirits over the past few days. She knew he regretted his decision to accompany James Walsh on board Mary Bernice. Sure now her father was quiet on a good day, but she could barely stand his sorrow on this evening. She hated to see him go with such a heavy heart. Though he had spent much of her childhood away at sea, her da always had time for her when he was home. Bride chased him from morn to night then, shadowing his every move. She followed him into the forest to cut wood and helped him haul the kindling into the horse cart. She would do anything to be near his side. Chores never bothered her a bit, as long as her father returned her efforts with a soft smile. She blinked back her tears as her father lifted his head to her now. "Goodbye, da," she told him as he held her close. He nodded and tossed his burlap bag over his shoulder. Bride watched as her father stepped out the door and down the small hill to the harbor. She held her eyes steady on his silhouette as he flung his duffel in the dory and seated himself inside the boat. Setting the oars in the thole pins, his thick arms rowed slow, steady strokes, rippling the waters as he pointed the bow toward Marystown and the schooner that waited for him. Bride knew he would not turn to look at her, would not turn to wave for fear of summoning ill luck. She closed her eyes and said a silent prayer for her father's safe return. "Love you, Da," she whispered in the chill night air. As Richard Hanrahan pulled on the dory oars in the dark, thousands of miles to the south, a small storm brewed in the warm Caribbean waters. Just northwest of the Turks Islands, the tempest continued to gather strength as it whirled past the Bahamas and headed north. Chapter 12. Heading into the Storm, Newfoundland, June 2003. I reach for my father's hand as the jagged coast of Newfoundland appears. The barren landscape rises up from below, unforgiving patches of boulders, soaring cliffs, and scrub brush. Fishing boats provide the only sign of life, their wakes, white, feathery trails, stark against the dark ocean. 3,000 feet above the sea, my father, sister, and I sit in a small plane that carries us north toward the land where our Irish ancestors immigrated more than a century ago. We have remained quiet during most of our early morning flight, lulled into silence by the rhythmic drone of the propeller that whirs loudly outside our window. 2 hours into our journey, the province known as the Rock, for its rugged glacier-ravaged terrain, comes into view. The sight of this island, the sight of Newfoundland, the realization that we are actually nearing my grandfather's homeland, jars me awake. I breathe deeply, trying to contain the rush of emotions this country stirs. From his aisle seat, my father leans toward the window. His brown eyes take in the coast of Newfoundland as it grows larger, closer. The knowledge that we are almost there, nearing Ambrose's birthplace, prompts him to sigh, a breath that is long and deep. For much of the flight from Boston he has exhaled often, as if trying to release the worries that bubble up inside him. He has had many second thoughts since he agreed to accompany my sister Joni and me to Marystown. A few days before our journey, my younger sister Laura spoke with him on the phone. "So," she asked, "are you excited about your trip?" "How the hell do you think I feel?" he erupted. "I don't know these people or what they're going to say about my father." The night before we left, he sipped from his red wine glass as Joni, my mother, and I sat in the living room of my parents' home. Our suitcases sprawled out on the floor. Joni and I tried to repack our clothes, eliminating extra baggage for our early morning journey. My father, who hated to be late, especially if it involved a flight, church obligation, social event, or a golf tea time, had already packed his small duffel and watched as his daughters folded and refolded piles of clothes. "You know, if you two weren't going, I'd be changing my mind right now," he told us. I, too, worried that maybe this trip was a bad idea. Though I was excited to learn more about the August Gale and my great-uncle Paddy, I was not so eager to hear stories about Ambrose, stories that would rekindle my father's childhood pain and anger. Neither my dad nor I slept well the night before our flight. Both of us fret before long-distance travel, and this particular journey presented more than the usual, "Will I make the plane? Will there be delays?" angst. The following morning we rose at 5 a.m. with dark circles beneath our eyes. After quick cups of coffee and a 40-minute ride south to Boston's Logan Airport, we dragged our suitcases and carry-on bags from the car. My mother hugged and kissed each of us goodbye, and as I drew her close, I noticed her eyes were shiny with tears. I hugged her one more time as she told me, "I wish I was going with you." My mother, Patricia Enos Walsh, loved travel and adventure. At a young age, she acquired her father Daniel's curiosity and a yearning to explore. On Sunday mornings, Daniel Enos packed his 5 kids and wife in the sedan and set off, determined to find new vistas. Carrying on her father's wanderlust, my mother has traveled to Portugal, England, Ireland, and New York City with my sisters and me, trips she savored more than all of us put together. And though she knew this excursion to Newfoundland would be memorable, she decided that it was best experienced without her, a journey to be made by 2 daughters and their father. At the airport curb, she stuffed her homemade granola bars into my pocketbook and waved goodbye before retreating to the car. And this is where we'll end episode 7 of August Gale by Barbara Walsh. I'm Susan Wall. Thank you for listening.